Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs, Friday, February 23, 1979, 1 p.m., Hearing Room B. Hearing on the executive appointment of Jane F. Houston, Director of the Department of Commerce. Senate Bill 470 relating to mortgages. Senate Bill 458 relating to employment. A work session on Senate Bill 428 relating to employment practices.
Meeting will come to order. We have a number of bills for introduction. With your permission, should I read them all?
Well, Mr. Chairman, all I would ask is that...
Have you got a copy of them there? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I really think that... As I look through the other committees, and we keep getting a lot of bills from various committees that do not designate where they come from, all I would ask is that these bills delineate where the bills come from so that the other legislators will have an opportunity to know.
I think that if the bill is requested by anyone, it's mandatory that we name who has requested the bill.
Well, the law isn't clear on it. I read the statutes the other night, and what the statutes say is that if someone comes with a bill that's already written in whole, then you're required to do so. But if someone just comes with the idea and the individual legislator or legislative council does the basic writing, then you're not required to do so. But I'd just like to ask that as a courtesy, and if there's any objection, why, of course, we could talk about it.
To delineate the name as they're requested by?
Right.
I think they're all on here now, it would read. On the backing, on the bill backing, it would necessitate it. Yeah, right, they are.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Must these all go to rules?
No, not if they're introduced as committee. Yes, they will have to go to rules.
Yeah.
These all, yes, necessary, all these bills go to rules.
That's what I thought.
After they clear here. But I think it's just a matter of sitting there, really,
well,
no problem.
They can still turn it down.
They could, yes.
Sure.
So, George, do you want to...
Well, it's no problem. I'd just like to ask that the name appears on that those who request these appear on the bill.
I think the reason for it is that they want to know who has requested the bill. I put in bills and always put the name of those that requested as a matter of courtesy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that if I would propose that we introduce all of these. The question of the necessity for the late introduction is a Rules Committee question, which ought to be addressed on each one. And rather than duplicating that kind of a question, I just merely move that we introduce all of them. They have to be reviewed again by rules and may be turned down unless the reason for their late introduction is a qualified reason.
Question of later introduction, as I recall, it's a Senate rule that if all bills that, unless they're sponsored, I could have put all these bills in it and they introduced them as an individual, as a senator. They've been in legislative council and have just come up from legislative council.
Oh.
They've all been drafted, so they're not...
Oh, they were timely in their request.
They were in their timely
request.
They're
in the printing process, I see.
In the That's time it. They came out of legislative council.
I so moved.
Okay. Are there any objections? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Next in line is a confirmation of executive appointment of Jane F. Houston. Would you come forward, and Roger, would you introduce Ms. Houston? Yeah, you have a folder before you, which I think gives a resume of Ms. Houston.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and although I am a lobbyist, I'm appearing here as an individual because this is not anymore involved with my lobbying activities. Shortly after the 1978 general elections, Governor Attia asked me something that I thought demonstrated a real thoughtfulness on his part, and he said, did you have anyone in mind had you been successful for various appointments to state government? And I said, no, I really didn't get far enough down that track to even think about it. And I did say, well, there was one individual that I had always thought about appointing, and I would like to appear here briefly to introduce you to Jane Houston, who is the one individual that I had in mind had I been so fortunate to have succeeded. Very briefly, the Department of Commerce, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is an agency that guides 60 different divisions and boards within the Department of Commerce. The department has over 500 employees which license and regulate a variety of businesses and professions in the state of Oregon. Governor Attia has given specific instructions that these regulations should be reasonable, thorough, but not strangulating. And the divisions that are included, the major divisions within the Department of Commerce, are the Banking Division, Consumer Services Division, the Corporations Division, Housing, Insurance, Real Estate, Building Codes, as well as the State Fire Marshals. There are numerous state licensing boards also that report to the director, and these include a variety that most of you are familiar with, from accounting through architect examiners, engineering, and tax service examiners. To do all of this, the biennial budget of the department is about $25 million. And finally, the director also advises the governor on various decisions that affect both the businesses and the professions that are regulated. So much for what the agency does. I first met Jane Houston in 1973 when I was her neighbor. She was a resident on, as a matter of fact, I rented a home from her mother here in Salem, and she was working at the time for the city of Salem. Shortly
I was just going to say that doesn't qualify her being a neighbor of yours.
That's very true, Senator. That's very true. She at the time was an employee of the city of Salem working in their housing various programs. 2 years after that, she took a job with a national organization called Apt Associates, headquartered in Massachusetts, which is an agent or a company that I'm sure Jane can explain that does a variety of consulting kinds of programs for both federal and state government. In order to qualify for her job, she attended a course to get her master's degree from the University of Pittsburgh. And I remember, and I'm sure she wouldn't bring this up, the time she was hired, she was told that this would be very difficult because she would be competing with various middle echelon corporate executives from some of the major corporations of the United States. And she said, fine, I'll be happy to do that. She graduated from that course at the University of Pittsburgh, number one in her class. She's a magna cum laude graduate of Willamette University, and I think a person who's very qualified to be in addition to the government of the state of Oregon, and I'd like to see her come back from Massachusetts to Oregon, and I think that's all you need to hear from me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Other questions? Did you have anything to say on behalf of yourself, Ms. Houston?
I would like to say, and thank you very much, Roger. That was a glowing introduction. I am very pleased to be here. Delighted to have been appointed by Governor Attia to this position as Director of the Department of Commerce. I feel that it is something I have been gearing toward for quite a few years. I have worked in government, both in city government and in state level government, and then because I also was curious and interested and drawn to the private sector. As Roger said, I did take a job with a private firm, Apt Associates. I did receive my Master of Business Administration because I like what the private sector can do also. So I feel that I have one foot in each side now. I know the government side and I know the private sector side, and I feel that I am a good judge of where the two can mesh together and how they can interface to work together. And the government is for the service of the people, and I will look forward to carrying out that role in the role that I will be playing in Department of Commerce.
Are there any, yes, Senator Trow.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm really impressed with the academic qualifications of the candidate, and I'd like to have her comment just a little bit about the experience of attending a liberal arts college and doing exceedingly well there, as you obviously did, with a major in French, and then kind of juxtaposing that and going on to get an MBA, and how do they mesh together? Think they help?
Well, I think I can probably answer that very simply from...
Excuse me, would you talk in the microphone in the back? Everybody wants to hear you and they can't quite hear you.
I think I can answer that fairly simply by reminding you of the year in which I graduated from Willamette University, which was 1943, and that was the year of the wife and mother and the liberal arts education, and that's when women learned to do those things and did not really aspire toward the business world. However, as I came out of those years, I found myself drawn more and more to the business world and to industry,
to higher education and so on. My first job for money was running the Oregon Job Fair. And I am meeting some of the men whom I met at the time when I helped put together 125 of Oregon's largest businesses and industries and government agencies to put on a week-long exhibit and a conference at the Coliseum in Portland. And I think at the time that's when I decided that the corporate world was a very interesting world and proceeded on down that line too.
I like your answer, but I was hoping maybe you would say that good liberal arts education is also good preparation
for
business.
Well, I do believe that.
let me ask you about another thing. You'll be head of an important department when your appointment is confirmed, and there are lots of parts of it, clearly. One of the parts is the Division of Consumer Affairs, or whatever the technical description of that is. In terms of your background, what's your attitude about the consumer part of your responsibilities?
I believe that having been and being presently a consumer, I can identify very clearly with the consumer side of the world of business. And again, through my school experiences, having taken business law, contracts, some of the more interesting parts of business dealing with the consumer, it alerted me to a lot of the things that are happening now as far as the role of the consumer in dealing with business and the business being responsible for what happens with their products as related to the consumer. As with business and industry versus government, again, I feel I have one foot on each side and will be able to look clearly at both sides and see the merits on both sides of things which come up between the two.
Another question relates to another part of the responsibility, and that's you sort of have all of these licensing boards to superintend, and we've been in the process of looking at those licensing boards. Some of them have been sunsetted, and we've had some hearings on them and so forth, and occasionally we run into one that really hasn't done much in terms of carrying out its licensing responsibility. I think we ran into one that didn't meet for a whole year, never had a meeting at all, skipped a whole year in terms of meeting. So I was wondering if you take a good look at those you're going to and see about what's happening with them.
Yes. Governor Attia has charged me with going into the department and examining the workings of it in the various departments and responsibilities. And that, of course, is what I intend to do first, is to try to learn as thoroughly as possible what everybody does and why. And then I'll be able to make some informed decisions about what happens.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Smith.
Mr. Houston, I think that you're highly qualified for this position. I have a personal question to ask you. How's your golf game?
Well, Roger was just asking me, and I would just be delighted to make up a foursome with some of you one of these days.
I'd enjoy that. What's your handicap?
I'm not going to tell until after we get off the first tee.
I know. Very well spoken.
Okay, Senator Wingard.
Yes, Mr. Houston, I know we've discussed the licensure boards, but I'd like to answer a question on that subject, if you would. Do you believe that the various licensure boards tend to inhibit job opportunity to those who are inexperienced, or the young, or the disadvantaged?
I don't think you can generalize. I think that there are rules which probably are as helpful as they are harmful to the people who are trying to get into the particular fields. Again, I think that each one will have to be looked at carefully and specifically, because there is a purpose, and it's a good purpose, for licensing and regulation of business. But on the other hand, we mustn't let it impede what's happening either. So I would not like to give a general answer, yes or no, to that.
Well, let me whet your appetite a little bit and be more specific. We require that fence builders here in the state of Oregon are bonded, for instance, and pay fees and be licensed They also require that licensure of landscape contractors, in other words, those who plant plants around your home, and be bonded and serve a sort of indentured servitude period of time. And okay, on one of those two, do you have any feelings on those two areas as a specific rather than as a general subject?
Yes, I suppose that I do. I like to see license or a registration which stands for some specific thing for which the consumer can be made aware that that is what the license or the registration stands for. If someone does not have that and the consumer has an opportunity to make the decision that they will hire somebody who does not have one, it may be a perfectly legitimate thing. In the specific case, again, I would have to look carefully at what is required for someone to have a license, whether it's the amount of business they do, whether it's how they represent themselves, whether it's in their advertising and so on. But there may well be a place for non-licensing of some kinds of professions.
How would you feel about consumer contract simplification laws?
Would you explain that a little more?
For instance, if we passed a bill this session, or say if we didn't, would you support an effort to pass a bill, for instance, that would require that consumer contracts read at a certain reading level?
No.
So that people could understand the contracts better?
Perhaps. I am interested in simplifying things so that people do understand them. On the other hand, and again, it sounds like I'm straddling the fence, but I must say that I understand the purpose of legal language, because many of our decisions are made in court between attorneys and a judge, and we'll have to make a leap forward in several different areas before seemingly we can have a very simple kind of agreement that will suffice.
We'd have to get rid of a lot of attorneys, I guess.
Everything hurts somebody.
Well, yes, and it's very important, I think, that we talk about that just a moment. That's really what your job is all about. It's a job of protection, but is it a job of protecting those who don't need to be protected? And, you know, it's a very delicate
balance. It is a thin line. And I do believe that government exists and regulations exist and licensing exists and so on to protect the people who need protection. But I can also see where, for instance, you seem to be saying consumers versus businessmen. That is not always an appropriate pitting one against the other either.
Well, I don't think I'm saying that, but what I am saying is, it's you're doing a very good job, quite frankly, of straddling the fence on those questions. But we found that we talked about reading simplification laws a couple sessions ago, and we were told that you just can't violate certain legal terms in contracts or in certain writings because you would affect all this court case law. Well, we found that isn't true, though, after we researched it a good deal. And I'm looking for a little more than just the way of doing things that we've always done. I'm trying to search you out. Are you set in your ways on this subject?
No, I'm not. And I will say that I had an excellent course under Professor Murray, who is the writer of a very large book called Contracts. And we learned those specific things about what is possible and what is not possible in written and verbal agreements between the buyer and the seller. And I am not opposed to new ways and new things if they are better.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir, you're going to make the move.
Senator
Hanlon has a question for
you. Question, if you please. On at least three occasions during this session, certain boards and commissions that are part of the Department of Commerce have appeared before a committee in which I serve. And in each case, they have asked for the right to levy civil penalties upon those who they license in certain instances of violation. Senator Kulongoski, who isn't here, and I have expressed a feeling that perhaps government should not get into that. We are being criticized rather widely because government is too pervasive now. And both Senator Kulongoski and I are very apprehensive about giving government any more power than they now have. We'd like them, I think, to consider more seriously arbitration of differences. Questions raised by the consumer against a contractor who is licensed by one of your boards. Rather than a question, a suggestion, would you please take a look at that, try to keep government out of it, try to have those differences under arbitration or some sort of a resolution other than the heavy hand of government assessing a civil penalty?
I'll be pleased to look into that very thoroughly. Thank you.
I might say, Senator Hanlon, if she carries out Governor Atiyah's charges to Oregonians for reasonable regulation, not strangulation, she should accomplish that. And would, I presume you agree with...
Yes, I agree with Governor Atiyah's policy.
Senator Smith? I want you to know that Senator Smith stayed here. He has a doctor's appointment and he's in great pain. He wanted to stay here so he could...
I am also a graduate of Willamette University. I want you to
okay.
I approve the...
Confirmation of Ms. Houston. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hammond?
Aye.
Senator Hannon? Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Stroll?
Aye.
Senator Wingard?
Aye.
Senator Kulongoski? Senator Brown?
Aye. Confirmation has been confirmed. Let's go to Senate Bill 470. Was that the one I think we had?
Yes,
470. Okay. David Barrows.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm appearing here today, Mr. Chairman, as President of the Oregon Savings and Loan League, and I've also been asked to speak on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Last session, the legislature passed legislation introduced by Senator Walt Brown dealing with the imposition of late charges on single-family owner-occupied residential property by state-chartered institutions. The bill was extensively amended in this committee, and Mr. Chairman, I was involved in those, in drafting the amendments, and I made an error in drafting them in that I said that the materials that were to be found in the agreements between the parties dealing with late charge information and restrictions should be placed in the mortgage, and it should have read, and I would hope that it would read when the session is concluded, that this information can be provided in either the promissory note or the mortgage. The practice in the industry is in many times the late charge provisions between the parties are found in the promissory note rather than in the mortgage. And I would hope the committee would approve this legislation and permit the industry to follow the normal practice. It is really a housekeeping bill, Mr. Chairman. It was an earlier in the section in the code dealing with late charges, I do make reference to note or mortgage, but I failed to do so in 86165.
Sorry, we don't have a quorum here, so...
We can get him off the hook.
Do you have any questions?
No, I think we ought to pass the bill. I really like to get him off the hook.
I'm really... I'm not sure. You know, looking at the...
I understand, Mr. Chairman. Maybe that's the problem you have, sir.
So, there's only three of us here, so we probably... Could I have the subsequent hearing later in the session?
At your pleasure, Mr. Chairman. I would.
Okay. If there's nothing further, why we will, on this bill, anyone further to testify on this bill? If not, why we'll go to our next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
We got a quorum now.
Okay, let's go to Senate Bill 458.
We have a quorum now. I'll move the bill out.
Do you want to vote on that? Neither Senator Trow nor...
Trow was here.
I was there.
Trow, I mean, Senator Hanlon wasn't here, and Senator Kulongoski wasn't here. Do you want to vote on this bill?
Oh, this is the bill that Mr. Barrows goofed up last year.
Well said, Senator.
I understand where we're at.
Any objection? If not, Clerk, Senator Wingard moves that Senator Brown's bill be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Would you like to give the number?
Senate Bill 470. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hanlon?
Aye, I think.
Senator Hannon, Senator Smith, Senator Crowell,
aye.
Senator Wingard,
aye.
Senator Kulondowski,
aye.
Senator Groner,
aye.
Just a second, Barrels. I don't want this to show up on your CNE when you report it.
How do you vote, sir?
Aye.
Okay. Senator Wingard, I think you should carry that.
You can talk about loofers.
Yeah. Senate Bill 470, having received a majority, is declared passed. Let's go to Senate Bill 458. Okay, is Anita Paulson and Dick Ginsburg?
Good afternoon. My name is Anita Paulson. I am a lawyer and the legislative coordinator for Oregon Legal Services Corporation. OLSC, legal aid service that provides free legal assistance to Oregon's low-income rural population. Sitting next to me is Dick Ginsburg, who is the director of our farm worker office. He is the primary drafter of the legislation you are considering today. We are here today.
Just a matter of interest. Where does your money come from? Who funds you?
The Federal Legal Services Corporation. We are here today representing the Oregon State Clients Council, which is an organization of low-income people that have been or are eligible to be our clients. The idea for this bill originated in our farm worker office, but the problems it addresses are faced by workers in many occupations. For that reason, the Oregon AFL-CIO has endorsed this proposal. I would like to say also that the wage claim statutes are very complicated. In some instances, they are poorly drafted. The sanctions provided for their enforcement are ineffective. We have been working with the Bureau of Labor, Paul Tiffany, and Vic Levy of the Department of Justice. We will be proposing some amendments in accordance with their excellent suggestions. Also, Evelyn Ferris is here today with a possible amendment, and Steve Cafori, though he is not here today, has some possible amendments that he would like to submit. With this, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Dick, who will explain in detail the provisions of this bill.
Thank you. Senate Bill 458 attempts to address problems with making current existing Oregon law effective. It proposes no new concepts which would change any of the obligations of employers. Rather, it proposes the idea of civil statutory damages to enforce laws that are currently sanctioned by criminal penalties. This legislation, we feel, is necessary because many of the things that employers are currently required to do, such as establishing and maintaining regular paydays, not discriminating against workers who make wage claims, providing workers with itemized statements, are violated on a daily basis. I see clients principally in the field of agriculture and see these violations in almost every situation. The worker has no ability to bargain compliance with the law. If they complain, they're usually fired and blacklisted. And often, if they're involved in a wage claim because of violations of these laws, which are contained in Titles 652 and 653, the lack of a written record makes the resolution of the wage claim very difficult, and they often lose. I did a little bit of research into the number of prosecutions that have been brought under the criminal sanctions that are currently the penalty for violations of these laws. I spoke with the district attorney's offices in Multnomah and Washington counties, with the state attorney general, and with the people at the Bureau of Labor. I was unable to find evidence of a single violation brought for failure to comply with any of these items. Obviously, these are not major crimes, they're not priority items. Often it'll be a prominent political or economic defendant in a rural community. District attorney would not be inclined to prosecute. So the criminal sanctions, from what I have been able to find out, are gathering dust and providing no deterrence to prevent the violations of these laws. The mechanism we are proposing is not a new one. It currently is used in 652.150, which provides civil statutory damages for the failure to pay wages upon termination of employment. We feel that while employers may not be afraid of criminal sanctions, which have not been enforced, that they will think twice if there's an attack on the pocketbook. This will add the teeth that we feel are necessary to make these laws effective. 652.150, the civil statutory damages, has been around a long time. It's been invoked a lot, and it's both our opinion and the Bureau of Labor expressed the opinion that it is effective in limiting violations. As Anita mentioned to you, these laws, this area of the law is very complex, and it's not an easy task to provide an alternative mechanism. The committee may certainly want to consider alternative suggestions, and the Bureau of Labor people, I think, would have some that are also excellent suggestions. I do want to stress to the committee that we have a large problem with the violations of these laws. Many workers are affected and unable to cope with the problem. The suggestions that we have put into this bill would do the following. They would, as I mentioned, provide a deterrent to the violation of the law. They would give the victim, the worker, the power to bargain both the prevention of the violation of the law and to redress violations if they happened. It's a self-help bill, and we feel it would be at minimal or no cost to the state. And if I might address a comment made by Senator Hanlon earlier in this afternoon's session, we feel that this would not be more government involved in the lives of employers, because these would be civil statutory damages. It would not be arbitration, as you suggested, but it would be the use of the courts rather than the government coming in and imposing a sanction on someone. Very much a victim's compensation bill, where the wrongdoer, the employer, would be compensating the victim, and the state treasury would not be compensating the victim. We have provided the committee with a chart which helps explain what the bill does, and I would like to go into some of the specifics and some of the laws under 652 and 653 that would be affected by this bill. The first one concerns establishments where perishable or seasonal commodities are handled. The requirement for the prompt payment of wages on termination of employment exempts this industry. The language of this exemption is really not clear. I might read it. The proviso, it's on page 2 of the bill, line 8. It says, provided that in establishments where perishable or seasonal commodities are processed or handled, when termination of employment results from fluctuation in or cessation of the flow of such perishable or seasonal commodities, such termination shall not be regarded as a discharge or termination by mutual agreement within the meaning of this section, but all wages earned at the time of such termination shall become due and payable not later than the regular payday on which such wages normally would be paid. To me, it sounds like a lawyer drafted that. And we see this causing some hardship for certain migrant farm workers, not all of whom would be working in a cannery industry, but in other industries handling perishable crops, perishable commodities, which really any agricultural employer handles. A lot of workers go from one job in one area to another job elsewhere, within the state or without the state.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hanlon.
It's also a potential hardship on the employers. I can imagine a case where you're harvesting, it rains, everything stops for 3 or 4 days. If we change the language, they've got to come up with a payroll.
Well, Senator, I think that you have a valid point, and what we're concerned with is not where there's a cessation for 2 days or 3 days within a pay period. We're not urging that all workers be paid at that point. Rather, what we are interested in is where there's a termination of employment with that individual worker who is going to go on and not come back when the work commences again.
For example, if someone is paid once a week on Monday, the job ceases on Tuesday, there's nothing left to pick, they have to wait around until the next Monday. Evelyn Ferris is here today, and she is with the cannery operators, and she brought up the circumstance where they might not have work to do for maybe 2 days, but they're local people, and they're going to stay on. We didn't really want to cover those, and I think that problem can be remedied by amendment. What we're trying to get at is a situation where you have a migrant that wants to move on to his next job, might not have enough money to go there unless they're paid, have to wait in one place for a week.
And probably not being able to provide a forwarding address at the time of leaving the area.
Chairman.
Because they don't know exactly where they'll be. And if there's a pay dispute and they're 100 miles away, they effectively cannot resolve that with the employer. This is a situation that we are more interested in. And I think we could satisfy your comment with an amendment.
I'm willing to do that.
Anita, you know, I'm sorry, but I've read that section, the italicized part, and I want you to direct yourself to the phrases. Well, the first two lines, provided that in establishments, the first word is in establishments, and I want a definition of in establishments, and in the second line it says where perishable or seasonal goods are processed or handled.
Mm-hmm.
The problem I have with it, I don't think it directs itself to the picker. I think that this definition and that exemption was put in by the cannery people to take care of the position that Evelyn Ferris is going to tell you about. It's a cannery amendment. And it was never intended to cover the people out on the farm, because I think they were clear. I think another word for establishment is a cannery, and they're talking about processing or handling. And I think it was the idea of what you said. I think what the example she gave you is exactly what happens. I guess my point is, I think it's a very narrow exception to the law.
I agree with you in some respects, Senator Kulongoski, but there is no definition of establishments, and we have, though not a lot of instances where farmers have not paid for a week, generally in retaliatory type of conduct. A lot of them will pay when they do leave, but a lot of them will say, no, you have to wait until the next week and rely on this provision.
I see. Thank you. Go ahead.
To continue, 652.150, which is the civil damages for termination, failure to pay promptly upon termination, exempts from those damages employers who are financially unable to pay when the wages are due. We have proposed in the bill that this proviso be eliminated because we again feel that it works an unnecessary hardship. Financial hardship is a hard term to define and is vague. Many employers and their accountants could show on the books that the employer is suffering from financial hardship when the employer may indeed continue to have lines of credit, inventory, personal property, investments, and other resources available. I've spoken with many farmers who complain about their financial hardship, and I don't want to question that farmers have some financial hardship, but I'm not sure that that type of hardship should justify exemption from the penalty. I see this as being an easy way to avoid the sting of the civil damages when, in fact, the wages that should be paid to the worker may be invested somewhere else at the time for a short period. It weakens the deterrent effects of the statute, and it awards unwise business habits and clever bookkeeping habits. Someone who really can't pay their workers should not be employing the workers. The next section deals with the medium of payment. The statute already requires that workers be paid in either cash or a negotiable instrument. I'd like to tell you about a client that our office has now, and he wanted to come today to tell you his own story, but because he has a job and couldn't get away, he was unable to make it. He is paid by his employer, well, it's an ex-employer now because he finally had to leave, with a check, personal check from a bank in Washington County. He happens to bank at the same bank but a different branch office. The employer's credit is apparently so shaky that the only place he can cash the check is at the branch where the employer has the account. He can't even go to a different branch. And he ends up having to travel a long distance to get his paycheck cashed. Another section of the bill would create civil damages to prohibit the discharging or otherwise other types of discrimination against employees who file wage claims or who file overtime or minimum wage claims. The Bureau of Labor has indicated to us that they're very much in support of legislation which would create such civil damages. This is something with farm workers which is rampant and, in a sense, keeps everyone down at the farm, down on the farm and quiet, because the threat of retaliation or of losing the job or of getting a type of work which is going to, if it's piecework, pay less, is always there, and it's the thing that keeps most workers from complaining about any violation of these laws.
Which, the bill is, which section are you on now?
This would be section 4. Well, subsection 4 of section 2. It's on page 3 at line 7. Again, this has a criminal sanction at the present time. We have not found any prosecutions of it, of individuals for violation of it. But we see this type of discrimination with almost every client that comes into us. We're also proposing in the bill to, in a different section, and this would be...
Let me say this before you go any further. What I intend to do, I intend to, obviously the bill in the, it's Senator Kulongoski's bill, is one of the principal sponsors. I intend to appoint a subcommittee in with Senator Kulongoski, Chairman, and Evelyn Ferris, and perhaps one of you, whichever wishes, to see if you can't clean up the bill and bring it back to us. So I wouldn't spend too much on the time on the bill because this is Friday afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, I would even suggest that Mr. Fredericks be appointed to the subcommittee to work with us on this measure.
Well, Leon, I think you ought to have somebody from the Farm Bureau.
From the Farm Bureau?
Sure, I agree.
And I think you ought to, when you come back with the bill, I want to see documented evidence of violations of these. I want documented evidence of violation.
Dick, let me ask you a question. So they understand the bill. The bill doesn't attempt to basically change the substantive law as far as what constitutes a violation of the statutes. Is it not merely adding civil penalties where presently the law provides for criminal penalties?
That's correct.
And that's the whole purpose of it.
Yes, there are one or two minor exceptions to that, okay. Such as perishable industry
That's the thrust.
My point, Mr. Chairman, is that, and he may well be right, the reason that various district attorneys don't prosecute is because, you know, it's us folks out here. But I would like, some examples to know how rampant the problem is. I understand what the bill tries to do.
Okay, any further questions? If not, thank you. Evelyn, do you want to testify or at this time, briefly?
What you got ready for next time?
For the record, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Evelyn Ferris, and I represent the Oregon Food Processors Council. Senate 1, or Section 1 of the bill, is, of course, the one we're particularly concerned with. The exemption granted food establishments, food processing establishments previously, has been removed from the law. There are about 40 food processing plants in the state of Oregon. During the summer peak season, these plants employ approximately 25,000 people, more than four-fifths of which are seasonally employed. The fruits and vegetables which are processed in these plants are, as the committee knows, perishable by nature. They cannot be stockpiled. I'll try to paraphrase this a little, Mr. Chairman, since time is of the essence. They are harvested, transported, and must, for the most part, be taken care of in one day. Because of weather conditions and because of sometimes equipment breakdown, it's necessary to close down the plant for a day or two, sometimes even longer. Under the bill as it's now drafted, by removing the deleted language, this would require an employer to immediately pay out for the time worked, even though that employee was coming back to work maybe in the next day or two. This presents a hardship for many of the plants. For instance, AgriPac has three plants, one in Salem, one in Eugene, and one in Junction City. They handle about 5,000 people at a time on the payroll. The payroll is computerized at Salem, and it would be costly and almost impossible if you had a shutdown for a day or two in Eugene or in Junction City to have to process those checks. I might say also that so far as we are aware, when we discussed it at the board meeting, nobody was aware of any complaint that's ever been made by any of the workers on this account. I would direct the committee's attention also to sections 2 and 3, because in sections 2 or 3, they provide that an employee, if he gives notice, more than 48 hours notice, can have his check right away. If notice is not given, then the employer must give the check within 48 hours anyhow. So I really can't see how you would have a long lapsing of time in any event, in any industry, I'm not just speaking of the canning industry, before that check was due and payable. In the canning industry, we do pay weekly. If there were a breakdown or if the person quit or anything like that, in any event, it would be a short time before he was paid. For this reason, Mr. Chairman, we're asking that the committee give favorable consideration to our amendment. Our amendment is very simply, it would simply restore the language which has been deleted in Section 1. Might point out also, and maybe this is something the subcommittee will want to study, that there is another bill in the legislature.
You're on the subcommittee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, the difference between Section 2, Section 1 deals when the employee's discharged.
Right.
Section 2 deals with when he quits.
Yes.
And that's why the 48-hour notice.
But also, the last part of Section 2, it says, if such notice is not given, such wages shall be due and payable 48 hours, excluding Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays, after such employee has to quit his employment.
Any further questions? If not, thank you, Evelyn.
Thank you.
Carl, do you represent any farm...
No, but I will make sure that someone from the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation
is there.
If
either works, Senator Sue and Godfrey.
Could I make just one real quick comment?
Sure.
Carl Frederick with Associated Oregon Industries. There is another bill that this committee has, and you haven't had a hearing on it. Senate Bill 228, which speaks to the problem we're talking about in this bill, and that is the collection or obtaining wage claims. And the Attorney General of the Department of Justice has come up with a little different approach. He gives an administrative action, and limited research I've done on, we would approve of that particular approach as opposed to this one of giving a new cause of action. I think the subcommittee probably might want to delay until the Department of Justice has had a chance to explain their bill and what they're trying to do.
Yeah,
228.
When do we have a hearing on that?
When's the second?
March the 2nd.
Oh, you got one scheduled.
One second. So if you want to, I think that Senator Kulagoski could proceed with it at that time, and when we have 220, hold it up until we get 228 with a subcommittee hearing. Mm-hmm. If you'll bring in, I don't know who you have from the Farm Bureau, but...
I'll check with someone from the Farm Bureau.
Someone from the Farm Bureau. Okay. There's nothing further why this...
Work session.
On 458, and we'll go into a work session on...
428.
I want to ask Ben Bieberness and if he could come up here and
Robert Mariani.
Bob Mariani. And let's just briefly go over this bill, if you want to.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. What is the reason? The reason for the bill now, as I understand it, is that the company, when you take a day off and you're genuinely sick, or they require, before you come back to work, to see a doctor. Is there a reason for that? They want you to see a doctor to see if you're physically fit to go back to work? Is that the reason?
I don't know what their concern is. If I may identify myself, I'm Ben Beavers.
You have no idea what their concern is, why they want you to have a doctor to know why.
Would you like to have some prepared testimony here, then? If you'd
What's
like
that?
I have some prepared testimony here that deals with that very thing, probably.
Okay, well, if you give that part of it, you know, if you testified once before the committee, but this one question I wanted, is it strictly that you're off and you're genuinely sick? This is all I want to know. Is you're off, you're genuinely sick, and you feel that that it's unjust for them to require a doctor's examination before you come back to work?
No, sir. I do not feel it's unjust for them to require us to have a physical or a doctor's certificate in order to come back to work. I do feel it is unjust for us to have an extra monetary forfeiture in requiring us to pay for the doctor's visit.
Let me ask you this. You're a union official. Have you had much trouble with absenteeism as far as...
With absenteeism?
Yes.
I mean, people taking off from work and saying they're sick and not reporting to, and could it be that the company wants this information for the for this purpose, that they want to know if you're actually sick, because we have a few individuals, and maybe more than a few, an ever-increasing number that say, well, we're not coming to work because, and when they're called and asked to come to work, they say, well, they're sick, and they want a doctor's verification after so many such instances to actually ascertain whether they were sick or not, or...
I can see what you're getting at.
Yeah.
Okay, and let me answer that, too. Okay, Bob would like to answer that. I feel that in many cases, the men do use this as an excuse, primarily because there is no other way for them to relieve themselves from duty. There again, is the company use it as a matter of intimidation to force their employees to work when there is actually no need for this intimidation? Why can't they give their men off? I don't think this is our primary concern. We are not concerned with the fact that they're using this type of a setup. In other words, that they're saying, okay, you want 2 days off, 4 days off, 6 days off, but you're going to have a doctor's receipt to come back to work. We find no quarrel with this, Senator. We do find the quarrel with the fact that the people that are off and have to go get a doctor's release to come back to work.
Well, I think, let me ask you this. If you're asking your employer for days off just because maybe they want a few days off, they don't feel like going to work, that's a different situation, I would think, than to use it as an excuse. And I don't imagine they would if the employer would grant you the time off. If you want to take, if you said, well, my mother-in-law died and I have to end the funeral or whatever, you're off 3 or 4 days. But what I'm talking about is that the man that's constantly, and we have this in the shipyards and I'm aware of it, and other places where many of your young people and some not so young, they're having a great difficulty. They don't show up for work, they'll call in sick. And yet they have no evidence, and I realize that it could be, they could have a cold, and normally I don't go to the doctor I haven't had a cold for 25, 30 years, but if I had one, I wouldn't go to the doctor regardless.
Right.
But when they're off for a length of time, it seems to me 48 hours or more, that they should, that they say they're sick, that the employer has to have that someone on that train, and I imagine if man doesn't show up for work, they're in trouble, that they could delay the train and the leaving the station with wherever they're destined.
We've got no argument with the requirement, sir. Absolute no argument with the requirement whatsoever.
Just pain, but...
The only thing is we're arguing with is to manage the pain.
Do you think it's up to the employer then to pay for that, even though...
Yes, sir. If they require it.
Even though a man is flaking off... And
if they require it, sir. We feel that if they require it, and I think the trigger is in the word if they require you to have a physical examination or a medical certificate to come back to a job that you already own, then they should...
Regardless, you have a man over and over that's using that excuse. And
They have the power, sir, to bring this man in send him down to probably an independent physician and have a medical or physical examination of him if they feel that this man is a go-breaker or whatever you want to call him.
Are there any further questions by members of the committee? We have some others to...
Yeah.
About Mary.
I don't have a question along that line, but I do have, you appointed me to the subcommittee that dealt with the people who were concerned about this bill. You remember there were a group of people who came basically, I think, from the hotel or motel industry, and we worked out an amendment with them. They were the only ones who really came forward at the time of the hearing to suggest one. So we have an amendment, which is a however clause, which qualifies the main statement in section one that I'll recommend to the committee.
Okay.
After the meeting, Mr. Kalinowski came up and wanted to be added to the subcommittee and had a suggestion also. And I thought that he had cleared it with Mr. Bieberness and others, but I guess I misunderstood what had happened. Anyway, I did authorize him to have another however clause drafted, and he has had one drafted, too. So we have two proposed amendments,
Senator,
to Section 1.
Senator, the railroad were unaware that this was of the bill at the time, and I don't know if they have a legitimate excuse. But the reason that I'm asking these questions, they were up in my office shortly after you were there the other day, and I heard nothing about that there was absenteeism or this had anything, was totally unaware that the question of absenteeism entered into this. And this is a reason that they are here today, and I'd like to, Senator Draw, if you don't mind, and I appreciate what you've done, if we could hear from maybe Oglesby Young with the Oregon Railroad and Eldon
Forbus? Mr. Chairman, all I want to say is, if with regard to the subcommittee, that we've completed our work. I have one amendment that I will recommend and one amendment that I'll submit to you with no recommendation.
Fine. Senator Groner.
And who?
Mr. Telfer.
And Mr. Telfer also has an amendment, I believe, but we'll call on you later. Do you want to come up here and Mr. Young and Mr. Forbus?
Senator Groner, may I appear?
Oh, I'm sorry.
May I appear after Mr. Young appears?
Sure, would you rather appear now or doesn't matter?
Afterwards.
All right, I don't care. If you want to sit up here with him, sit right here. If there's any questions, we'll ask you. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Oglesby Young. I'm a general solicitor for Southern Pacific Company, lawyer in Portland, Oregon, a director of the Oregon Railroad Association. My office address is 800 Pacific Building, Portland, Oregon, 97204, and I'm appearing on behalf of all of the major railroads in Oregon. To my left is Mr. Eldon Forbus, who is an employee of Southern Pacific Company. He's the agent at Eugene, Oregon, and as the agent, is responsible for the work of 200 clerical employees. Mr. Chairman, I think the colloquy between you and Mr. Bibernus rather clearly indicates that what we really have here is a labor grievance. And unfortunately, a legislative bill, in my opinion, has been introduced to resolve what is, in effect, a labor grievance. I don't want to dwell too long on this subject, but we have a federal law called the Railway Labor Act, which sets up machinery for handling such labor grievances. And this very grievance has been handled in that federal machinery. And there is a ruling of Mr. Bibernus, general chairman. Have you distributed this, Mr. Miller?
I'd like to see a copy, and I'm sure the committee would be interested in that.
Now, this is the top page I'll be circulating to you. It's from Mr. Bibernus, general chairman in San Francisco, addressed to all local chairmen. And you'll note the last line recites, and the decision is attached to the letter, the decision only settles the question of who pays. And we're talking about the question of who pays for this medical release, which is involved in this legislation. Now, under the Railway Labor Act, when we have a dispute like this, it has to be given to a board, an adjustment board. And if you'll look at the third page I've given you, you'll see three names. One is the chairman, and he's usually a lawyer, a hearings officer. The second is the employee member, that's a UTU member, Thornton, and the third is the SP man, Sherling. Now, this is binding arbitration, which under federal law we must have for questions like this, and this decision, issued in 1978, decided that if an employee lays off for longer than 2 days, then that employee has to pay for his medical release. If it's less than 2 days, the carrier has to pay for it. Now, that's been the law, so to speak, with Southern Pacific ever since this decision came out, and Mr. Bibernus knows it. I fail to understand how this can be introduced. Now, to go a step further, that's just the interpretation of a labor agreement. We have labor agreements which look like this between the clerks, the UTU, and all the railroads in the state of Oregon, Burlington Northern, Union Pacific, Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Southern Pacific. These labor agreements were negotiated, and I have before me a labor agreement with Burlington Northern and the Brotherhood of Railway Clerks, which is Mr. Mariani's union. Now, in labor agreements, as you all know, there is give and take. And in this particular labor agreement, they dealt with the subject of sick leave. And Burlington Northern and other railroads all agreed that they would give their employees supplemental sick benefits. And as to Burlington Northern, I've attached on the fourth page of this attachment the supplemental sick leave benefits. Now, this is over an addition and in addition to what they regularly get from railroad unemployment. In the case of BN, they get, as you will see from the attached sheet, after they've been there 20 calendar years, 20 benefit days with 80% of their pay. In the case of SP, I think it's 10 years, and Mr. Forbus can correct me if I'm wrong, they get 100% of their pay. That was the quid pro quo, as I indicate in the attachment, for the agreement that the employees may be required, in case of doubt, to present satisfactory evidence of sickness and a release. Now, this was negotiated with all the railroads. In exchange for these extra benefits, they agreed to this. Now, I'm really at a loss, gentlemen, to understand why the Oregon legislature has a bill like this before it when we have a decision from the Adjustment Board and labor agreements covering this very subject. And I'm sorry that we were not here beforehand, but we...
Yes, all those people, do they have a separate union up here in Oregon that operates separate of this San Francisco?
No. Now, let's take the...
Beaverness is operating out of San Francisco, and his boss is down there, and he doesn't have any... He has to abide by whatever this is?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we'll take the United Transportation Union. You understand we have 20 or 30 unions with each railroad. Now, the United Transportation Union is a union that governs the brakemen, sometimes called cranemen, the switchmen, the conductors. They're consolidated into the UTU. They have local lodges on SP throughout the so-called Pacific Lines. That includes Oregon, California, Nevada, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, west of El Paso. Those local unions have a general chairman, a man who is the general chairman of UTU, who sits in San Francisco and meets with management. So Mr. Thornton, who's the general chairman, is in effect the chief man for the UTU SP union in San Francisco. And he is the one who had this problem presented to the Adjustment Board in San Francisco, and it was decided this letter is addressed to all local chairmen of the UTU. That includes local chairmen of those unions in the state of Oregon.
Let me ask you this. Is it compulsory that these local chairmen, like these various brotherhoods that are around the various states that you mentioned, that they can't negotiate separately, if they have to abide by the decision of the general chairman?
Well, it's not the decision of the general chairman. It's a decision of an adjustment board, and the general chairman is a party to it. They are bound by it, just like the law of the federal government, yes. As to this sort of thing, they are bound by it. Now, let me put the shoe on the other foot for a minute, just to really put this in focus. Let's say that I, or Mr. Forbes, as representatives of management, the company, came in here and introduced a bill asking that Oregon adopt the law requiring employees who laid off less than 48 hours to pay the cost of a medical release. Let's say the railroad was doing that. What do you think we would hear from Mr. Beavness? Why, they can't do that. This board has ruled. But precisely the same thing is happening in reverse.
Mr., will you want to sit up there and answer this? Evidently, Mariani, you have a good answer. I would think you would better have. Because if that's the truth, and if what we hear there is the truth, I'm a strong believer that you should, if you have a problem that should be settled among yourself and your unions, this is what you have a union for, you should be negotiating them.
Well, particularly when we have the federal government, which has already set up the procedure for this, and we both used it, both sides have used it, and this is the result.
Okay, what is your...
Thank you, Senator Groner.
Is any of this true, what he says, or is this just a bunch of hokum?
Well, I don't want to say it's not true. I don't think Mr. Oak ever lies. He deviates from some of the things we do, some of the things we have. However, I'm glad that he is here, but Mr. Oak Young works for the Southern Pacific.
So you don't you?
He doesn't know what's going on the BN, apparently, because he definitely stated that they require a doctor's certificate for any time you're off sick for more than 2 days. I have a claim pending with the Burlington Northern for 1 day. So they don't pay for the doctor's certificate for 1 day. So what we're talking about here, we're not talking about...
Well, let me see if I understand you. As I understand, if it's less than 48 hours, they pay for it. If it's over 48...
That's what Mr. Oak Young said, yes.
That's the Southern Pacific. That's the ruling.
That's Southern Pacific.
Right.
Right.
What I aim at is 1 day. In other words, if we call in sick for 1 day sickness with a little headache or a stomach upset or some minor non-serious illness and we do not require medical attention, what we're saying is that the employer should pay for that 1 day sickness to see a doctor if he requires it. Now, we're not asking for 2 days or 4 days. Now, it is required that if we're off for 4 days, we have to see a doctor in order to collect our sickness benefits. For 1 day, we're not required to see a doctor, but if we are forced to see a doctor, we feel that the railroad should pay for it. Not the railroad, the employer. Now,
are there some railroads, Oglesby, that require that they see a doctor are different than what you know. I understand Southern Pacific requires 48 hours in the past, they have to pay 48 hours and less. You pay for it if you require an examination, right? But is that true of Burlington Northern? And
you see, Mr. Chairman, we don't really have the answer, as Bob Mariani has said, and I believe Bob Mariani just as he believes me. We're not calling names to one another. All I'm saying is we have machinery set up to resolve this question, and it shouldn't be for the Oregon legislature. Now, yes. Let me go on. There is a case, as Bob says. I just talked to the personnel manager, Western Line, the Burlington Northern, this morning before I came down here. And there is a case, and it's being handled by the local chairman up there in Seattle. What's his name? Peeler Palafemu?
Palimpomo. We have one here
it's
in Portland.
It's an $18 too. Claim.
Mine's $15.
A clerk in a customer accounting center who's making an $18 claim under the Railway Labor Act before a board, just as was done with the UTU. And that case is going to be decided in St. Paul, the headquarters of Burlington Northern, where that general chairman is. And what I'm saying here is, why must the Oregon legislature be bothered with this sort of thing when the very thing is being decided under the machinery provided by federal government on the BN as well as the SP?
Senator Gorner, I think we're deviating from the real issue here. As I stated in my prepared testimony on 15th of February, I think what we're trying to do is to reduce the medical cost, the health care, and it's sensible. It's not sensible to see a doctor when you have a headache and pay that extra $15, $20, or $25 cost. This just skyrockets the cost of medical care. So what we're trying to do is to reduce it. So if we don't have to see a doctor for a headache, I don't think there'll be that cost involved. And the less cost we have with the doctors and hospitals, the better it is for the employees and employer. Now, we negotiate our health plans.
Let me ask you this. Why don't you negotiate this with the railroads rather than coming here with a bill to the Oregon legislature?
Well, Senator Gorner, every time we come in with a bill to the Oregon legislature, it's either a negotiable item, or it's preempted by federal government, or it's preempted by the federal law, or one of these things. Other states don't have this problem. Now, Washington has a similar law that we're attempting to introduce here. Minnesota has a similar law. California has a similar law. They're not having any problems. Other employers aren't having this problem. So, and they have passed similar law. Why can't we pass similar law here in Oregon so that
would
we don't have to
federal law forbid you to negotiating this item here?
Pardon?
Would federal law preempt you negotiating for what we're discussing here today?
Well, Senator Gurr, nothing will prevent me from negotiating any agreement. If he wanted to negotiate an agreement that he will pay for a medical cost for the first 2 days, I'd be willing to do this.
What I'm saying is, why couldn't you negotiate that with your next agreement? Bring it up and get this involved. Get involved. What I'm saying is this, and we had the same thing, maximum eight-hour day, CWA union, and I asked them during the last session, why don't you negotiate it? They said, well, we haven't been successful. Well, the legislature is going to take care of everything that labor is not successful in negotiating, we can spend an entire session. If they're not happy with their wages, I suppose the legislature could set their wages. But it takes a not that I object to it. I'm willing to help you, and we have helped you. But this is why we have labor union contracts. Why we have unions. It's up to you as a union leader to look out for your employee. And if there's a case where you think that the employee is being taken advantage of, you should go down there and pound the table and see that these problems are ironed out. But we could be
Senator Gorner.
I can tell you what I'm telling the public employees right now. Now that they have public employees collectively bargaining, we won't give them anything. They can bargain for it. You know, in fact, there's a move now to take away their tenure and some of these things that they have gotten through the legislature and legislature in years past and let them bargain for it. I believe in collective bargaining. I'm sure you're a strong supporter of collective bargaining.
Yes, sir, I am. And as you know, the liberal movement isn't aimed at helping their own people. We also like to help other people. We're always supporting minimum wage benefits, increasing right. The minimum wage. And 90% of those people don't belong to the union. Only probably about 30% of the people working in Oregon belong to the unions. The other 70% don't.
Court. And the other 70% may be having the same problem that we're having. And we would like to help them, too. And maybe I think, it's incumbent on the legislature to help them.
Maybe they'll have an excuse. In other words, you're not really interested in your own interest because you can negotiate that, but you've got this bill in for the interest of the others, 70% that are not represented.
This bill doesn't mention the railroads. It mentions employers. And the members who are working for these employers who are requiring them to see a doctor, forcing them to see a doctor for one day sickness.
Are there any questions here by the committee? And this is something that I was unaware of, that when I first heard it, and I never knew, and I might say yesterday I talked to some of them there, but it is a negotiable item. You would agree to that?
No, sir. I don't think it is.
It's what, you're preempted by the federal government?
No, I don't think this is a negotiable item. It can be. Many things can be negotiable items, but I don't think there was aim at negotiating.
I mean, this directive they had that we have here from your...
UTU.
UTU?
You see, was that labor, it is. It's negotiated in this manner. Under the federal law, the union and management must go to binding arbitration under the Railway Labor Act. And that's what the UTU and SP did on this very subject. Who pays the cost? And what I said was, the BN now has exactly the same case SP had, and it's pending right now in St. Paul. And it involves Mr. Mariani's union. And when that decision is made, that is going to be binding on Mr. Mariani, it's going to be binding on Burlington Northern. And you legislators, in my opinion, just waste your time if you're considering this measure for the railroad, because it's being decided at the federal level.
Bob said he's interested in the other 70% that are not represented. He's not so much interested in the railroad.
I have, because it is a matter preempted by the federal government, I have suggested an amendment which is attached to the packet of papers I've given you, and we will accept from this employees where such costs have been assumed by an employee in a binding labor agreement or have been imposed upon an employee by an arbitration decision rendered pursuant to federal law. Those are attached to the papers. And that would, I think, take care of the railroads. And if Mr. Mariani is doing this for other labor organizations, he should have no objection to that.
Would you agree to that amendment then?
I will agree to Mr. Oaks Young interpretation that the railroads pay for anything less than 2 days. That's what he stated, and I will agree to that.
They're doing that now.
No, they're not.
On SP, they are.
On SP?
Mr. Young represents all the railroads.
Yeah.
But they're not doing it on the BN. If we could come to some kind of...
Well, how come you can get an agreement with SP and you can't get agreement with other railroads? Is that our fault here? You know, Ben?
Seems like this is chastised beaver to say. This agreement that Mr. Young came up with is a binding agreement put out by an arbitration board, Senator. In other words, the two parties interested, the United Transportation Union and the Southern Pacific Transportation Company, could not reach any sort of an agreement. So they go to a neutral member. Now, we hope that he's a neutral member. Not always do we feel that he's a neutral person, but we assume that he is. And he is assumed and agreed upon by both parties involved. In this case, the neutral member, who is, I don't remember what it was, Hannon?
Paul Hannon.
All right, Paul Hannon. Very well-respected man out of Portland, Oregon, by the way. Said that anything over 48 hours. Now, remember, this thing has been going on for years and years and years. I mean, I'm talking about many years, and it's been trying to be negotiated on for many years. It could not be. So finally, somebody made a test case on it. Paul Hannon says, okay, it's unreasonable to expect the railroad to have an absenteeism of over 48 hours, and then the employee shall pay for the medical cost. Anything under 48 hours on the SP property, the employee-er shall pay for, which is fine. All right. And how about the innocent party that gets involved in this? How about the guy that's got a flu, he's got a stomach ache, he don't feel like going to the doctor. How many times have you called up the doctor and said, hey, doc, I got a stomach ache?
Never.
I
just take some Alka-Seltzer.
Yeah, right. Take two aspirin and go to bed, right?
Yeah.
So he'll take, go to the doctor, or your wife, go to the doctor, and get the prescription, and Not too good in 4 or 5 days, give me a call back and we'll take a look at you. Okay, so the prescription works. The man's back to work. He's already lost 4 days' work, 5 days' work maybe. And yet the carrier says, mister, if you're going to be off, you're going to pay for that doctor this week. Yeah. I don't think that's fair.
What about the guy that says, I like to go hunting this week, I'm going to take a week off, and he says,
all right, there's machinery set up for that. And I think most of the people say, okay, Mr. Young, you're our train master out here, I want to leave absent for 5 days. 6 days, 7 days, 2 weeks, 31 days.
But they report.
They say, okay, Mr. Beaver, sign on the dotted line, you got the time off.
But don't they report sick and they get paid for it?
No, we do not have a sick leave.
Don't you have a sick leave?
We have absolutely no gift of benefits, no. Except under the Railway Sickness Act, and then there's the doctor's. You have to be off 7 days.
I see.
And then you have to go to the doctor and all this other stuff involved. I think we mentioned this piece of legislation to Mr. Young, Mr. Cutter, about 3 months ago. And we talked to our particular superintendent, who was involved. And he laughed in our heads.
Steve, you want to come up here, too? I think Steve. Telfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Steve Telfer. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, and the Oregon School Boards Association. Mr. Chairman, you've made my point for me. All I wanted to point out with my testimony is that we have a public sector collective bargaining statute. We think, as a matter of public policy, this is a bargainable issue, and that we ought not be legislating bargainable items to protect against alleged abuses in a very small segment of the working force. I have attached out of our files excerpts from 3 separate labor agreements that are current, one from a city, one from a county, and another from a school district. You'll note that in each case they deal with sick leave, and they deal with an issue of helping the management prevent abuses in sick leave by simply requesting a doctor's verification. And those, as a matter of course, usually don't occur unless it's a protracted situation.
This bill acts right. It would affect every city, every...
Every employer in the state.
State of Oregon.
Chairman. Now, we have, in addition to that, Mr. Chairman, on the statutes now, ORS 342.596, subsection 3, says at the option of the local governing board, this is talking about school districts now, sick leave in excess of 5 consecutive work days shall be allowed only upon certification of the school employee's attending physician. So we already have a statute that rather specifically permits the use of a physician. On the very last page of my testimony, I have attached a proposed amendment, which we think would work, which simply would eliminate... Well, in fact, what I've done is taken the other amendments that have been suggested to you, incorporated them all in one, and added collective bargaining agreements as an exclusion.
You know, I've talked to the public employees. It was the Oregon State Employees Association. Some of them have said, we wish you'd take away all of our benefits that we've got by statutes. We'd like to show what the union can do and get credit for it, you know. And it seems to me that with the union negotiating these things, it makes a stronger union. That we fought for it and we got these benefits for it, and coming to the legislature and seeking these benefits, I was unaware that they were negotiable items. Otherwise, if it's not negotiable, we should confine it to the railroad, and I don't think that we should do it, because our other union says we don't want it in the statutes. We like to fight it out, and we like to get it. We like to get credit as far as the people that our employees are concerned. Ben?
Well, sir, I did talk to some other labor organizations when I was going to draft it, and they seem to be in full support.
What? Bob Kennedy?
Carl Fredericks, he didn't, in the first meeting.
Carl Fredericks?
He represents, I don't know how many.
That's not correct. As a matter of fact, my people were the first one to draft it out. The rest
were they?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I asked him at the time of the first hearing there, and he said, I've got personal problems, but he says I didn't have anything with the bill.
So. Well, even the public employees are telling us that now, though.
Well, and perhaps it's the best thing to do, and you say we don't. I've got no say in that.
But I am willing to leave the bill here and see if you can work on it. But I was unaware when I talked to you the other day when you testified that there was a problem with absenteeism. And there is a problem with absenteeism. You know, I don't know if it's a day or we live in, but I think many people my age, when they had a job, they valued it. And boy, I'd worked one time 48 hours in a stretch, and I was making big money, $1 an hour, you know. And we'd work day and night because we valued it. We wanted to make money and get ahead, you know. But it seems to me that you have a number of people today that take time off, and we have that problem. I noted in many of the industries in the metropolitan area where they're not reporting to work the next day, and the employer depends on them. And I would imagine that this is happening, and I do understand it's happening in the railroad business, where they have a difficult time at times getting a crew, where men are just not available, they're off sick. And I tell you, if I were an employer and that happened, I think I would be real unhappy. if this were to happen, then I would say that the employer needs some protection in this instance, too. I hope you don't think I'm being negative, because
I think
it's my background. Yeah, you know.
I think the railroad pointed out that they have a problem with the building, that they have an absentee problem. And that's the reason right. They have an absentee problem. Maybe it's because, number one, they don't have enough employees. And number two, because the majority of their employees, if they are working, especially on the train off part of it, these guys are working 7 days a week, 10, 12 hours a day. We just got legislation passed here about 4 years ago. It started dropping, or 6 years ago, it started dropping the hours of service. From 16, we got it down to 12. We talked about going to 10. We tried to go to 10. We thought about it. We could have gone to 65. But due to national negotiations, so I don't think that this absentee that the particular carrier's got. Is that any bearing on this bill?
Well, I've always thought that the brotherhoods and, years ago we had fights, the full crew law and whatnot, but I thought since then the brotherhoods and the railroads were working together and had much in common. I thought, in fact, the millennium had arrived as the railroads and the brotherhoods is concerned.
I think that's true.
And I hope that this continues, and I hope that what happened here today doesn't create any problems, because things I think that labor management relations have been much better in the past 4 or 5 years than they have in the past, and they're beginning to understand one another, and I hope this can continue, really. And I hope I haven't offended anyone here today, as oftentimes I do, Senator Kuhnkopf.
No, it's Mr. Chairman, you never offend me.
When is you don't like it,
you don't. There's nothing further to come before this committee. We are adjourned.